folk got too much to give up. Besides, they get the bad news first. Most of the peasants don't know everything's gone to Hood's Gate on Chernobacchus. A lot of them figure city folk whine too much anyway. May I ask why?
You may.
Lorn turned to watch the soldiers cleaning up the road.
I need a list of recent recruits within the last 2 days. Forget the ones born in the city, just the outlying ones, and only the women and or old men.
The captain grunted again. Should be a short list, adjunct.
I hope so, captain.
You figured out what's behind all this?
Still following the activity on the road below, Lorne said,
No idea.
Yes, the captain thought, and I'm the Emperor reincarnated. Too bad, he muttered.
Oh.
The adjunct faced him.
Lieutenant Parron is now on my staff. I trust you'll make the necessary adjustments.
As you wish, adjunct. I love paperwork.
That earned him a slight smile. Then it was gone.
Lieutenant Parron will be leaving now.
The captain looked at the young noble and smiled, letting the smile say everything. Working for the adjunct was like being the worm on the hook. The adjunct was the hook, and at the other end of the line was the Empress. Let him squirm.
A sour expression flitted across Parron's face. Yes, adjunct.
He climbed back into the saddle, saluted, then rode off down the road. The captain watched him leave, then said,
Anything else, adjunct?
Yes.
Her tone brought him around.
I would like to hear a soldier's opinion of the nobility's present inroads on the Imperial command structure.
The captain stared hard at her.
It ain't pretty, adjunct.
Go on.
The captain talked.
It was the 8th day of recruiting, and Staff Sergeant Aragon sat bleary-eyed behind his desk as yet another whelp was prodded forward by the corporal.
They'd had some luck here in Cannes. Fishing's best in the backwaters, Cannes' Fist had said.
All they get around here is stories. Stories don't make you bleed. Stories don't make you go hungry, don't give you sore feet. When you're young and smelling of pig shit and convinced there ain't a weapon in all the damn world that's going to hurt you, all stories do is make you want to be part of them.
The old woman was right, as usual. These people had been under the boot so long they actually liked it. Well, Aragon thought, the education begins here.
It had been a bad day, with the local captain roaring off with 3 companies and leaving not one solid rumor in their wake about what was going on. And if that wasn't bad enough, Lassine's adjunct arrived from Unter shortly afterward, using one of those eerie, magical warrens to get here. Though he'd never seen her, just her name on the hot, dry wind was enough to give him the shakes. Mage Killer, the scorpion in the Imperial pocket.
Aragon scowled down at the writing tablet and waited until the corporal cleared his throat. Then he looked up. The recruit standing before him took the staff sergeant aback. He opened his mouth, on his tongue a lashing tirade designed to send the young one scampering. A second later he shut it again, the words unspoken. Cann's Fist had made her instructions abundantly clear. If they had 2 arms, 2 legs and a head, take them. The Chernobacchus campaign was a mess. Fresh bodies were needed. He grinned at the girl. She matched the Fist's description perfectly. Still.
All right, lass, you understand you're in line to join the Malazan Marines, right?
The girl nodded, her gaze steady and cool and fixed on Aragon. The recruiter's expression tightened.
Damn, she can't be more than 12 or 13. If this was my daughter. What's got her eyes looking so bloody old? He thought.
The last time he'd seen anything like them had been outside Mott Forest on Chernobacchus. He'd been marching through farmland hit by 5 years' drought and a war twice as long.
Those old eyes were brought by hunger or death. He scowled.
What's your name, girl?
Am I in, then? She asked quietly.
Aragorn nodded, a sudden headache pounding against the inside of his skull.
You get your assignment in a week's time, unless you've got a preference.
Jennebach and Campaign, the girl answered immediately, under the command of Hyfist Ducek One-Arm, One-Arm's host.
Aragorn blinked.
I'll make a note, he said softly. Your name, soldier?
Sorry. My name is Sorry.
Aragorn jotted the name down on his tablet.
Dismissed, soldier. The corporal will tell you where to go.
He looked up as she was near the door.
And wash all that mud off your feet.
Aragorn continued writing for a moment, then stopped. It hadn't rained in weeks. And the mud around here was halfway between green and grey, not dark red. He tossed down the stylus and massaged his temples.
Well, at least the headache's fading, he thought.
Gerrim was a league and a half inland along the old Cairn Road, a pre-Empire thoroughfare rarely used since the Imperial raised coast road had been constructed. The traffic on it these days was mostly on foot, local farmers and fishers with their goods. Of them, only unraveled and torn bundles of clothing, broken baskets and trampled vegetables, littering the track, remained to give evidence of their passage. Elaine Mule, the last sentinel overseeing the refuse of an exodus, stood dumbly nearby, ankle-deep in a rice paddy. It spared Paran a single forlorn glance as he rode past. The detritus looked to be no more than a day old, the fruits and green-leaf vegetables only now beginning to rot in the afternoon heat. His horse carrying him at a slow walk, Paran watched as the first outbuildings of the small trader town came into view through the dusty haze. No one moved between the shabby mud-brick houses. No dogs came out to challenge him, and the only cart in sight leaned on a single wheel. To add to the uncanny scene, the air was still, empty of birdsong. Paran loosened the sword in its scabbard. As he neared the outbuildings, he halted his mount. The exodus had been swift, a panicked flight. Yet he saw no bodies, no signs of violence beyond the haste evident in those leaving. He drew a deep breath, slowly released it, then clicked his horse forward. The main street was in effect the town's only street, leading at its far end to a T-intersection marked by a single two-story stone building, the Imperial Constabulary. Its tin-back shutters were closed, its heavy banded door shut. As he approached, Paran held his eyes on the building. He dismounted before it, tying his mare to the hitching rail, then looking back up the street. No movement. Unsheathing his blade, Paran swung back to the constabulary door. A soft, steady sound from within stopped him, too low to be heard from any distance, but now as he stood before the huge door, he could hear a liquid murmuring that raised the hairs on his neck. Paran reached out with his sword and set its point under the latch. He lifted the iron handle upward until it disengaged, then pushed open the door. Movement rippled in the gloom within, a flap and soft thumping of air carrying to Paran the redolent stench of putrefying flesh. Breathing hard and with a mouth dry as old cotton, he waited for his eyes to adjust. He stared into the constabulary's outer room, and it was a mass of movement, a chilling, soft susurration of throats giving voice. The chamber was filled with black pigeons, cooing in icy calm. Uniformed human shapes lay in their midst, stretched haphazardly across the floor amid droppings and drifting black down. Sweat and death clung to the air thick as gauze. He took a step inside. The pigeons rustled but otherwise ignored him.
None made for the open doorway. Swollen faces with coin-dull eyes stared up from the shadows. The faces were blue, as of men suffocated. Perrin looked down at one of the soldiers. "Not a healthy thing," he muttered, "wearing these uniforms these days." "A conjuring of birds, to keep mocking vigil. Dark humor's not to my liking anymore, I think." He shook himself, walked across the room. The pigeons tracked away from his boots, clucking. The door to the captain's office was ajar. Musty light bled through the shuttered window's uneven joins. Sheathing his sword, Perrin entered the office. The captain still sat in his chair, his face bloated and bruised in shades of blue, green, and grey. Perrin swept damp feathers from the desktop, rummaged through the scrollwork. The papyrus sheets fell apart under his touch, the leaves rotten and oily between his fingers. A thorough eliminating of the trail. He turned away, walked swiftly back through the outer room until he stepped into the warm light. He closed the constabulary door, as no doubt the villagers had. The dark bloom of sorcery was a stain few cared to examine too closely. It had a way of spreading. Perrin untethered his mare, climbed into the saddle, and rode from the abandoned town. He did not look back. The sun sat heavy and bloated amid a smear of crimson cloud on the horizon. Perrin fought to keep his eyes open. It had been a long day. A horrific day. The land around him, once familiar and safe, had become something else. A place stirred with the dark currents of sorcery. He was not looking forward to a night camped in the open. His mount plodded onward, head down, as dusk slowly enveloped them. Fooled by the weary chains of his thoughts, Perrin tried to make sense of what had happened since morning. Snatched out from the shadow of that sour-faced, laconic captain and the garrison at Cannes, the lieutenant had seen his prospects begin a quick rise. Aide to the adjunct was an advancement in his career he could not have even imagined a week ago. Despite the profession he had chosen, his father and his sisters were bound to be impressed, perhaps even awed by his achievement. Like so many other noble-born sons and daughters, he'd long since set his sights on the imperial military, hungry for prestige and bored with the complacent, static attitudes of the noble class in general. Perrin wanted something more challenging than coordinating shipments of wine or overseeing the breeding of horses. Nor was he among the first to enlist, thus easing the way for entrance into officer training and selective postings. It had just been ill luck that saw him sent to Cannes, where a veteran garrison had been licking its wounds for nigh on 8 years. There had been little respect for an untested lieutenant, and even less for a noble-born. Perrin suspected that that had changed since the slaughter on the road. He had handled it better than many of those veterans, helped in no small part by the superb breeding of his horse. More, to prove to them all his cool, detached professionalism, he had volunteered to lead the inspection detail. He had done well, although the detail had proved difficult. He had heard screaming while crawling around among the bodies, coming from somewhere inside his own head. His eyes had fixed on details, oddities, the peculiar twist of this body, the inexplicable smile on that dead soldier's face. But what had proved hardest was what had been done to the horses. Crusted, foam-filled nostrils and mouths, the signs of terror, and the wounds were terrible, huge, and devastating. Bile and feces stained the once proud mounts, and over everything was a glittering carpet of blood and slivers of red flesh. He had nearly wept for those horses. He shifted uneasily on the saddle, feeling a clamminess come to his hands where they rested on the ornate horn. He had held on to his confidence through the whole episode. Yet now, as his thoughts returned to that horrid scene, it was as if something that had always been solid in his mind now stuttered, shied, threatening his balance.
the faint contempt he'd shown for those veterans in his troop, kneeling helpless on the roadside, racked by dry heaves, returned to him now with a ghoulish cast. And the echo that came from the constabulary at Gerham, arriving like a late blow to his already bruised and battered soul, rose once again to pluck at the defensive numbness still holding him in check. Perrin straightened with an effort. He'd told the adjunct his youth was gone. He'd told her other things as well, fearless, uncaring, lacking all the caution his father had instilled in him when it came to the many faces of the Empire. From a great distance in his mind came old, old words.
Live quietly.
He'd rejected that notion then. He rejected it still. The adjunct, however, had noticed him. He wondered now, for the first time, if he was right to feel pride. That hard-bitten commander of so many years ago, on the walls of Moxhold, would have spat at Perrin's feet with contempt, had he now stood before him. The boy was a boy no longer, but a man.
Should have heeded my words, son. Now look at you.
His mare pulled up suddenly, hooves thumping confusedly on the rutted road. Perrin reached for his weapon as he looked uneasily around in the gloom. The track ran through rice paddies, the nearest shacks of the peasants on a parallel ridge 100 paces from the road. Yet a figure now blocked the road. A cold breath swirled lazily past, pinning back the mare's ears and widening her nostrils as she flinched. The figure, a man by his height, was swathed in shades of green. Cloaked, hooded, wearing a faded tunic and linen leggings above green-dyed leather boots. A single long knife, the weapon of choice among Seven Cities warriors, was slung through a thin belt. The man's hands, faintly grey in the afternoon light, glittered with rings, rings on every finger, above and below the knuckles. He raised one now, holding up a clay jug.
Thirsty, Lieutenant?
The man's voice was soft, the tone strangely melodic.
Have I business with you?
Perrin asked, his hand remaining on the grip of his longsword. The man smiled, pulling back his hood. His face was long, the skin a lighter shade of grey, the eyes dark and strangely angled. He looked to be in his early 30s, though his hair was white.
"The adjunct asked of me a favour," he said. "She grows impatient for your report. I am to escort you. With haste."
He shook the jug.
"But first a repast. I have a veritable feast secreted in my pockets, a far better fare than a browbeaten Canny's village can offer. Join me here on the roadside. We can amuse ourselves in conversation, an idle watching of peasants toiling endlessly. I am named Topper."
"I know that name," Perrin said.
"Well, you should," Topper replied. "I am he, alas. The blood of a Tister and he races in my veins, seeking escape, no doubt, from its more common human stream. Mine was the hand that took the life of Unta's royal line, king, queen, sons, and daughters."
"And cousins, second cousins, third."
"Expunging all hope, indeed. Such was my duty as a claw of unsurpassed skill. But you have failed in answering my question."
"Which was?"
"Thirsty?"
Scowling, Perrin dismounted. "I thought you said the adjunct wished for haste."
"Hasten we shall, Lieutenant, once we filled our bellies and conversed in civil fashion."
"Your reputation puts civility far down your list of skills, Claw."
"It's a most cherished trait of mine that sees far too little opportunity for exercise these fell days, Lieutenant. Surely you'd grant me some of your precious time, since I am to be your escort."
"Whatever arrangement you made with the adjunct is between you and her," Perrin said, approaching.
"I owe you nothing, Topper.
except enmity. The claw squatted, removing wrapped packages from his pockets, followed by two crystal goblets. He uncorked the jug.
Ancient wounds. I was led to understand you've taken a different path, leaving behind the dull, jostling ranks of the nobility.
He poured, filling the goblets with amber-coloured wine.
You are now one with the body of Empire, Lieutenant. It commands you. You respond unquestioningly to its will. You are a small part of a muscle in that body. No more, no less. The time for old grudges is long past. So,
he set down the jug and handed Perrin a goblet.
We now salute new beginnings. Gano is Perrin, Lieutenant, and aide to Adjunct Lorne.
Scowling, Perrin accepted the goblet. The two drank. Topper smiled, producing a silk handkerchief to dab against his lips.
There now. That wasn't so difficult, was it? May I call you by your chosen name?
Perrin will do. And you? What title does the commander of the claw hold? Topper smiled again.
Lassine still commands the claw. I assist her. In this way, I too am an aide of sorts. You may call me by my chosen name, of course. I'm not one for maintaining formalities beyond a reasonable point in an acquaintance.
Perrin sat down on the muddy road. And we've passed that point?
Indeed.
How do you decide?
Ah, well.
Topper began unwrapping his packages, revealing cheese, fist bread, fruit, and berries.
I make acquaintances in one of two ways. You've seen the second of those.
And the first?
No time for proper introductions in those instances, alas.
Wearily, Perrin unstrapped and removed his helm. Do you wish to hear what I found in Gerim? He asked, running a hand through his black hair. Topper shrugged.
If you've the need.
Perhaps I'd better await my audience with the adjunct. The claw smiled.
You have begun to learn, Perrin. Never be too easy with the knowledge you possess. Words are like coin. It pays to hoard.
Until you die on a bed of gold, Perrin said.
Hungry? I hate eating alone.
Perrin accepted a chunk of fist bread. So, was the adjunct truly impatient, or are you here for other reasons? With a smile, the claw rose.
Alas, genteel conversation is done. Our way opens.
He faced the road. Perrin turned to see a curtain in the air tear open on the road, spilling dull yellow light.
A warren. The secret paths of sorcery. Hood's breath!
He sighed, fighting off a sudden chill. Within he could see a greyish pathway, humped on either side by low-mounded walls and vaulted overhead by impenetrable ochre-hued mist. The air swept past into the portal like a drawn breath, revealing the pathway to be of ash, as invisible currents stirred and raised spinning dust devils.
You will have to get used to this, Topper said.
Perrin collected his mare's reins and slung his helm on the saddle horn. Lead on, he said. The claw cast him a quick, appraising glance, then strode into the warren. Perrin followed. The portal way closed behind them, in its place a continuation of the path. Idkokan had vanished, and with it all signs of life. The world they had entered was barren, deathly. The banked mounds lining the trail proved to be more ash. The air was gritty, tasting of metal.
Welcome to the Imperial Warren, Topper said, with a hint of mockery.
Pleasant.
Carved by force out of what was here before? Has such an effort ever been achieved before?
Only the gods can say.
They began walking. I take it then, Perrin said, that no god claims this warren. By this you cheat the tolls, the gatekeepers, the guardians on unseen bridges, and all the others said to dwell in the warrens in service to their immortal masters.
Topper grunted.
You imagine the warrens as crowded as that? Well, the beliefs of the ignorant are ever entertaining. You shall be good company on this short journey, I think.
Perrin fell silent. The horizons beyond the banked heaps of ash were close, a vague blending of ochre sky and grey-black ground. Sweat trickled under his mail hauberk. His mare snorted heavily.
In case you were wondering, Topper said after a time, the adjunct is now in Unta. We will use this warren to cross the distance, 300 leagues, in only a few short hours. Some think the empire has grown too large. Some even think their remote provinces are beyond the Empress Lassine's reach. As you have just learned, Perrin, such beliefs are held by fools.
The mare snorted again.
I've shamed you into silence, then. I do apologize, Lieutenant, for mocking your ignorance.
It's a risk you'll have to live with, Perrin said.
The next 1,000 paces of silence belonged to Topper. No shifting of light marked the passing of time. On a number of occasions they came upon places where the ash embankments had been disturbed, as if by the passage of something large, shambling. And wide, slithery trails led off into the gloom. In one such place they found a dark, encrusted stain and the scatter of chain links like coins in the dust. Topper examined the scene closely while Perrin watched.
Hardly the secure road he'd have me believe. They're strangers here, and they're not friendly.
He was not surprised to find Topper increasing their pace thereafter. A short while later, they came to a stone archway. It had been recently constructed, and Perrin recognized the basalt as Untan, from the imperial quarries outside the capital. The walls of his family's estate were of the same grey-black glittering stone. At the centre of the arch, high over their heads, was carved a taloned hand holding a crystal globe, the Malazan imperial sigil. Beyond the arch was darkness. Perrin cleared his throat.
We have arrived.
Topper spun to him.
You answer civility with arrogance, Lieutenant. You do well to shed the noble hauteur.
Smiling, Perrin gestured. Lead on, escort. In a whirl of cloak, Topper stepped through the arch and vanished. The mare bucked as Perrin pulled her closer to the arch, head tossing. He tried to soothe her, but it was no use. Finally, he climbed into the saddle and gathered up the reins. He straightened the horse, then drove hard his spurs into her flanks. She bolted, leaped into the void. Light and colors exploded outward, engulfing them. The mare's hooves landed with a crunching thump, scattering something that might be gravel in all directions. Perrin halted his horse, blinking as he took in the scene around them. A vast chamber, its ceiling glittering with beaten gold, its walls lined with tapestries, and a score of armored guards closing in on all sides. Alarmed, the mare sidestepped to send Topper sprawling. A hoof lashed out after him, missing by a handspan. More gravel crunched. Only it was not gravel, Perrin saw, but mosaic stones. Topper rolled to his feet with a curse, his eyes flashing as he glared at the lieutenant. The guardsmen seemed to respond to some unspoken order, slowly withdrawing to their positions along the walls. Perrin swung his attention from Topper. Before him was a raised dais surmounted by a throne of twisted bone. In the throne sat the Empress. Silence fell in the chamber except for the crunch of semi-precious gems beneath the mare's hooves. Grimacing, Perrin dismounted, warily eyeing the woman seated on the throne. Lassine had changed little since the only other time he'd been this close to her. Plain and unadorned, her hair short and fair above the blue tint of her unmemorable features. Her brown eyes regarded him narrowly. Paran adjusted his sword belt, clasped his hands, and bowed from the waist. "Empress?"
"I see," Lassine drawled, "that you did not heed the commander's advice of 7 years ago."
He blinked in surprise. She continued,
"Of course, he did not heed the advice given him, either. I wonder what god tossed you two together on that parapet. I would do service to acknowledge its sense of humor. Did you imagine the Imperial Arch would exit in the stables, Lieutenant?"
"My horse was reluctant to make the passage, Empress."
"With good reason."
Paran smiled. "Unlike me, she's of a breed known for its intelligence. Please accept my humblest apologies."
"Topper will see you to the adjunct."
She gestured, and a guardsman came forward to collect the mare's reins. Paran bowed again, then faced the claw with a smile. Topper led him to a side door.
"You fool,"
he snapped, as the door was closed soundly behind them. He strode quickly down the narrow hallway. Paran made no effort to keep pace, forcing the claw to wait at the far end where a set of stairs wound upward. Topper's expression was dark with fury.
"What was that about a parapet? You've met her before. When?"
"Since she declined to explain, I can only follow her example," Paran said. He eyed the saddle-backed stairs. "This would be the West Tower, then. The Tower of Dust."
"To the top floor. The adjunct awaits you in her chambers. There's no other door, so you won't get lost. Just keep on until you reach the top."
Paran nodded and began climbing. The door to the tower's top room was ajar. Paran wrapped a knuckle against it and stepped inside. The adjunct was seated at a bench at the far end, her back to a wide window. Its shutters were thrown open, revealing the red glint of sunrise. She was getting dressed. Paran halted, embarrassed.
"I'm not one for modesty," the adjunct said. "Enter, and close the door behind you."
Paran did as he was bidden. He looked around. Faded tapestries lined the walls. Ragged furs covered the stone tiles of the floor. The furniture, what little there was old, Napan in style and thus artless. The adjunct rose to shrug into her leather armor. Her hair shimmered in the red light.
"You look exhausted, Lieutenant. Please, sit."
He looked around, found a chair and slumped gratefully into it. "The trail's been thoroughly obscured, adjunct. The only people left in Garam aren't likely to talk." She fastened the last of the clasps.
"Unless I were to send a necromancer."
He grunted. "Tales of pigeons. I think the possibility was foreseen." She regarded him with a raised brow. "Pardon, adjunct, it seems that death heralds were birds."
"And were we to glance through the eyes of the dead soldiers, we would see little else. Pigeons, you said?"
He nodded.
"Curious."
She fell silent. He watched her for a moment longer. "Was I bait, adjunct?"
"No."
"And Topper's timely arrival?"
"Convenience."
He fell silent. When he closed his eyes, his head spun. He had not realized how weary he had become. It was a moment before he understood that she was speaking to him. He shook himself, straightened. The adjunct stood before him.
"Sleep later. Not now, Lieutenant. I was informing you of your future. It would be well if you paid attention. You completed your task as instructed. Indeed, you have proved yourself highly resilient. To all outward appearances, I am done with you, Lieutenant. You will be returned to the officer corps here in Unta. What will follow will be a number of postings, completing your official training. As for your time in Itkokan, nothing unusual occurred there. Do you understand me?
Yes.
Good.
And what of what really happened there, adjunct? Do we abandon pursuit? Do we resign ourselves to never knowing exactly what happened or why? Or is it simply me who is to be abandoned?
Lieutenant, this is a trail we must not follow too closely. But follow it we shall, and you will be central to the effort. I have assumed, perhaps in error, that you would wish to see it through, to be witnessed when the time for vengeance finally arrives. Was I wrong? Perhaps you've seen enough, and seek only a return to normality.
He closed his eyes. Adjunct, I would be there when the time came. She was silent, and he knew without opening his eyes that she was studying him, gauging his worth. He was beyond unease and beyond caring. It stated his desire. The decision was hers.
We proceed slowly.
Your reassignment will take effect in a few days' time. In the meantime, go home to your father's estate. Get some rest. He opened his eyes and rose to his feet. As he reached the doorway, she spoke again.
Lieutenant, I trust you won't repeat the scene in the Hall of the Throne.
I doubt I'd earn as many laughs the second time around, adjunct. As he reached the stairs, he heard what might have been a cough from the room behind him. It was hard to imagine that it could have been anything else. As he led his horse through the streets of Unta, he felt numb inside. The familiar sights, the teeming, interminable crowds, the voices and clash of languages all struck Perrin as something strange, something altered, not before his eyes, but in that unknowable place between his eyes and his thoughts. The change was his alone, and it made him feel shorn, outcast. Yet the place was the same. The scenes before him were as they always had been, and even in watching them pass by all around him, nothing had changed. It was the gift of noble blood that kept the world at a distance, to be observed from a position unsullied, unjostled by the commonry. Gift and curse, he thought. Now, however, Perrin walked among them without the family guards. The power of blood was gone, and all he possessed by way of armor was the uniform he now wore. Not a craftsman, not a hawker, not a merchant, but a soldier. A weapon of the Empire, and the Empire had those in the tens of thousands. He passed through Toll Ramp Gate and made his way along Marble Slope Road, where the first merchant estates appeared, pushed back from the cobbled street, half hidden by courtyard walls. The foliage of gardens joined their lively colors with brightly painted walls. The crowds diminished, and private guards were visible outside arching gates. The sweltering air lost its reek of sewage and rotting food, slipping cooler across unseen fountains and carrying into the avenue the fragrance of blossoms. Smells of childhood. The estates spread out as he led his horse deeper into the noble district. Breathing space, purchased by history and ancient coin. The Empire seemed to melt away, a distant, mundane concern. Here, families traced their lines back 7 centuries to those tribal horsemen who had first come to this land from the east. In blood and fire, as was always the way, they had conquered and subdued the cousins of the Canese who had built villages along this coast. From warrior horsemen to horse breeders to merchants of wine, beer, and cloth. An ancient nobility of the blade, now a nobility of hoarded gold, trade agreements, subtle maneuverings, and hidden corruptions in gilded rooms and oil-lit corridors. Perrin had imagined himself acquiring trappings that closed a circle, a return to the blade from which his family had emerged, strong and savage, all those centuries ago. For his choice, his father had condemned him. He came to a familiar postern, a single high door along one side wall and facing an alley that in another part of the city would be a wide street.
There was no guard here, just a thin bell chain, which he pulled twice. Alone in the alley, Perrin waited. A bar clanked on the other side. A voice growled a curse as the door swung back on protesting hinges. Perrin found himself staring down at an unfamiliar face. The man was old, scarred and wearing much mended chainmail that ended raggedly around his knees. His pot helm was uneven, with hammered-out dents, yet polished bright. The man eyed Perrin up and down with watery grey eyes, then grunted.
"The tapestry lives."
"Excuse me?" The guardsman swung the door wide.
"Older now, of course, but it's all the same by the lines. Good artist, to capture the way of standing, the expression and all. Welcome home, Ganoes."
Perrin led his horse through the narrow doorway. The path was between two outbuildings of the estate, showing sky overhead. "I don't know you, soldier," Perrin said, "but it seems my portrait has been well studied by the guards. Is it now a throw rug in your barracks?"
"Something like that."
"What is your name?"
"Gamut,"
the guard answered, as he followed behind the horse after shutting and locking the door.
"In service to your father these last 3 years."
"And before that, Gamut?"
"Not a question asked."
They came to the courtyard. Perrin paused to study the guardsman. "My father's usually thorough in researching the histories of those entering his employ." Gamut grinned, revealing a full set of white teeth.
"Oh, that he did. And here I am. Guess it weren't too dishonorable."
"You're a veteran."
"Here, sir. I'll take your horse."
Perrin passed over the reins. He swung about and looked around the courtyard. It seemed smaller than he remembered. The old well, made by the nameless people who'd lived here before even the Canis, looked ready to crumble into a heap of dust. No craftsman would reset those ancient carved stones, fearing the curse of awakened ghosts. Under the estate house itself were similarly unmortared stones in the deepest reaches, the many rooms and tunnels too bent, twisted and uneven to use. Servants and groundskeepers moved back and forth in the yard. None had yet noticed Perrin's arrival. Gamut cleared his throat.
"Your father and mother aren't here."
He nodded. There'd be foals to care for at Emelau, the country estate.
"Your sisters are, though,"
Gamut continued.
"I'll have the house servants freshen up your room."
"It's been left as it was, then?" Gamut grinned again.
"Well, clear out the extra furniture and casks, then. Storage space at a premium, you know."
"As always," Perrin sighed, and without another word, made his way to the house entrance. The feast hall echoed to Perrin's boots as he strode to the long dining table. Cats bolted across the floor, scattering at his approach. He unclasped his traveling cloak, tossed it across the back of a chair, then sat at a long bench and leaned his back against the panelled wall. He closed his eyes. A few minutes passed, then a woman's voice spoke.
"I thought you were Nitgokan."
He opened his eyes. His sister, Tavora, a year younger than him, stood close to the head of the table, one hand on the back of their father's chair. She was as plain as ever, a slash of bloodless lines comprising her features, her reddish hair trimmed shorter than was the style. She was taller than the last time he'd seen her, nearly his own height, no longer the awkward child. Her expression revealed nothing as she studied him. "Reassignment," Perrin said.
"To hear? We would have heard."
"Ah, yes, you would have, wouldn't you? All the sly whisperings among the connected families," he thought. "Unplanned," he conceded, "but done nevertheless. Not stationed here in Unta, though. My visit is only a few days."
"Have you been promoted?"
He smiled. "Is the investment about to reap coin? Reluctant as it was, we still must think in terms of potential influence, mustn't we?"
Managing this family's position is no longer your responsibility, brother.
Ah, it's yours now, then. Has father withdrawn from the daily chores?
Slowly. His health is failing.
Had you asked, even in Itko Can? He sighed. Still making up for me, Tavora. Assuming the burden of my failings? I hardly left here on a carpet of petals, you may recall. In any case, I always assumed the house affairs would fall into capable hands. Her pale eyes narrowed, but pride silenced the obvious question. He asked, "And how is Felicien?"
"At her studies. She's not heard of your return. She will be very excited, then crushed to hear of the shortness of your visit."
"Is she your rival now, Tavora?" His sister snorted, turning away.
"Felicien! She's too soft for this world, brother. For any world, I think. She's not changed. She'll be happy to see you."
He watched her stiff back as she left the hall. He smelled of sweat. His own and the mare's. Travel and grime. And of something else as well.
"Old blood and old fear," he thought.
Perrin looked around.
"Much smaller than I'd remembered."
Chapter 2. With the coming of the Maranth, the tide turned. And like ships in a harbour, the free cities were swept under imperial seas. The war entered its 12th year, the year of the shattered moon, and its sudden spawn of deathly rain and black-winged promise. Two cities remained to contest the Malazan onslaught. One, stalwart, proud banners beneath Dark's powerful wing. The other, divided, without an army, bereft of allies. The strong city fell first. Call to Shadow. Felicien, born 1146. 1163rd year of Burn's sleep. 2 years later. 105th year of the Malazan Empire. 9th year of Empress Lassine's rule. Through the pallor of smoke, ravens wheeled. Their calls raised a shrill chorus above the cries of wounded and dying soldiers. The stench of seared flesh hung unmoving in the haze. On the third hill overlooking the fallen city of Pale, Tattersail stood alone. Scattered around the sorceress, the curled remains of burned armor, greaves, breastplates, helms, and weapons lay heaped in piles. An hour earlier there had been men and women wearing that armor, but of them there was no sign. The silence within those empty shells rang like a dirge in Tattersail's head. Her arms were crossed tight against her chest. The burgundy cloak, with its silver emblem, betokening her command of the Second Army's wizard cadre, now hung from her round shoulders stained and scorched. Her oval, fleshy face, usually parading an expression of cherubic humor, was etched with deep-shadowed lines, leaving her cheeks flaccid and pale. For all the smells and sounds surrounding Tattersail, she found herself listening to a deeper silence. In some ways it came from the empty armor surrounding her, an absence that was in itself an accusation. But there was another source of the silence. The sorcery that had been unleashed here today had been enough to fray the fabric between the worlds. Whatever dwelt beyond, in the warrens of chaos, felt close enough to reach out and touch. She'd thought her emotions spent, used up by the terror she had just been through. But as she watched the tight ranks of a legion of Maranth Black marching into the city, a frost of hatred slipped over her heavy-lidded eyes.
"Allies? They're claiming their hour of blood," Tattersail thought.
At the end of that hour there would be a score thousand fewer survivors among the citizens of Pale. The long savage history between the neighboring peoples was about to have the scales of retribution balanced by the sword.
"Shadunal's mercy, hasn't there been enough?"
A dozen fires raged unchecked through the city. The siege was over, finally, after 3 long years. But Tattersall knew that there was more to come. Something hid and waited in the silence. So she would wait as well. The deaths of this day deserved that much from her. After all, she had failed in all the other ways that mattered. On the plain below, the bodies of Malazan's soldiers covered the ground, a rumpled carpet of dead. Limbs jutted upward here and there, ravens perching on them like overlords. Soldiers who had survived the slaughter wandered in a daze among the bodies, seeking fallen comrades. Tattersall's eyes followed them achingly.
"They're coming," said a voice, a dozen feet to her left.
Slowly she turned. The wizard Hairlock lay sprawled on the burned armor, the pate of his shaved skull reflecting the dull sky. A wave of sorcery had destroyed him from the hips down. Pink, mud-spattered entrails billowed out from under his ribcage, webbed by drying fluids. A faint penumbra of sorcery revealed his efforts at staying alive.
"Thought you were dead," Tattersall muttered.
"Felt lucky today."
"You don't look it."
Herlog's grunt released a gout of dark, thick blood from below his heart.
"They're coming," he said. "See them yet?"
She swung her attention to the slope, her pale eyes narrowing. 4 soldiers approached.
"Who are they?"
The wizard didn't answer. Tattersall faced him again and found his hard gaze fixed on her, intent in the way a dying person achieves in those last moments.
"Thought you'd take a way through the gut, huh? Well, I suppose that's one way to get shipped out of here."
His reply surprised her.
"The tough facade ill fits you, Sale. Always has."
He frowned and blinked rapidly, fighting off darkness, she supposed.
"There's always the risk of knowing too much. Be glad I spared you."
He smiled, unveiling red-stained teeth.
"Think nice thoughts. The flesh fades."
She eyed him steadily, wondering at his sudden humanity. Maybe dying did away with the usual games, the pretenses of the living dance. Maybe she just wasn't prepared to see the mortal man in Hairlock finally showing itself. Tattersall prized her arms from the dreadful, aching hug she had wrapped around herself and sighed shakily.
"You're right. It's not the time for facades, is it? I never liked you, Hairlock. But I'd never question your courage. I never will."
She studied him critically. A part of her, astonished at the horror of his wound, didn't so much as make her flinch.
"I don't think even Taishran's arts are enough to save you, Hairlock."
Something cunning flashed in his eyes, and he barked a pained laugh.
"Dear girl,"
he gasped,
"your naivety never fails to charm me."
"Of course," she snapped, stung at falling for his sudden ingenuousness. "One last joke on me, just for old time's sake."
"You misunderstand."
"Are you so certain? You're saying it isn't over yet. Your hatred of our high mage is fierce enough to let you slip Hood's cold grasp. Is that it? Vengeance from beyond the grave?"
"You must know me by now. I always arrange a back door."
"You can't even crawl. How do you plan on getting to it?"
The wizard licked his cracked lips.
"Part of the deal," he said softly. "The door comes to me. Comes even as we speak."
Unease coiled around her insides. Behind her, Tattersall heard the crunch of armor and the rattle of iron, the sound arriving like a cold wind. She turned to see the 4 soldiers appear on the summit. 3 men, one woman, mud-smeared and crimson-streaked, their faces almost bone-white. The sorceress found her eyes drawn to the woman, who hung back like an unwelcome afterthought as the three men approached. The girl was young, pretty as an icicle, and looking as warm to the touch.
"Something wrong there," she thought. "Careful."
The man in the lead, a sergeant by the talk on his arm, came up to Tattersall. Set deep in a lined, exhausted face, his dark grey eyes searched hers dispassionately.
"This one?" he asked, turning to the tall, thin, black-skinned man who came up beside him.
The man shook his head.
"No, the one we want is over there," he said.
Though he spoke Malazan, his harsh accent was Seven Cities. The third and last man, also black, slipped past on the sergeant's left, and for all his girth seemed to glide forward, his eyes on Hairlock. His ignoring Tattersall made her feel somehow slighted. She considered a well-chosen word or two as he stepped around her, but the effort seemed suddenly too much.
"Well," she said to the sergeant, "if you're the burial detail, you're early. He's not dead yet."
"Of course," she continued,
"you're not the burial detail. I know that. Hairlock's made some kind of deal. He's thinking he can survive with half a body."
The sergeant's lips grew taut beneath his grizzled, wiry beard.
"What's your point, sorceress?"
The black man beside the sergeant glanced back at the young girl, still standing a dozen paces behind them. He seemed to shiver, but his lean face was expressionless as he turned back and offered Tattersall an enigmatic shrug before moving past her. She shuddered involuntarily as power buffeted her senses. She drew a sharp breath.
"He's a mage," she thought.
Tattersall tracked the man as he joined his comrade at Hairlock's side, striving to see through the muck and blood covering his uniform.
"Who are you people?"
"Ninth Squad, the second."
"Ninth?"
The breath hissed from her teeth.
"You're bridge burners."
Her eyes narrowed on the battered sergeant.
"The ninth? That makes you Whiskey Jack."
He seemed to flinch. Tattersall found her mouth dry. She cleared her throat.
"I've heard of you, of course. I've heard that..."
"Doesn't matter," he interrupted, his voice grating. "Old stories grow like weeds."
She rubbed at her face, feeling grime gather under her nails.
"Bridge burners," she thought.
They'd been the old Emperor's elite, his favorites. But since Lassine's bloody coup 9 years ago, they'd been pushed hard into every rat's nest in sight. Almost a decade of this had cut them down to a single undermanned division. Among them, names had emerged. The survivors, mostly squad sergeants, names that pushed their way into the Malazan armies on Genabacus and beyond. Names spicing the already sweeping legend of One Arm's Host.
"Detoran, Ansi, Spindle, Whiskey Jack," she thought.
Names heavy with glory and bitter with the cynicism that every army feeds on. They carried with them, like an emblazoned standard, the madness of this unending campaign. Sergeant Whiskey Jack was studying the wreckage on the hill. Tattersall watched him piece together what had happened. A muscle in his cheek twitched. He looked at her with new understanding, a hint of softening behind his grey eyes that almost broke Tattersall then and there.
"Are you last left in the cadre?" he asked.
She looked away, feeling brittle.
"The last left standing. It wasn't skill either. Just lucky."
If he heard her bitterness, he gave no sign, falling silent as he watched his two Seven City soldiers crouching low over Hairlock. Tattersall licked her lips, shifted uneasily. She glanced over to the two soldiers. A quiet conversation was underway. She heard Herlock laugh, the sound a soft jolt that made